Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, we hear about proposed legislation in New York to require hotels to train employees to recognize human trafficking. And we'll hear from an advocate of this bill, a child sex trafficking survivor.
I was sold by my family in 1969 as a six-year-old child.
Plus, a military wife turns full-time caregiver. Who's helping the caregiver? I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Tonight, 'cause in the pipe she'll fly to the motherland and sell love to another man. It's too cold outside for angels to fly. For angels to fly.
Little lady, your mind you've made up. Your injuries you can't hide with makeup.
A New York State Assemblywoman from the Hudson Valley region was at a Ritz-Carlton hotel in a New York City suburb recently. She was there in Westchester County to promote legislation she authored to require lodging facilities to provide human trafficking recognition training. Annika Lucas says she figures she was raped about 6 hours a week before age 12 during the time she was trafficked from 1969 to 1974.
I was sold by my family in 1969 as a six-year-old child. And I was sold into a murderous network.
This was in Belgium, and she says the pedophile network operated in Europe, its members, aristocrats, and leaders. She told her story in a video.
It went viral, and I got a lot of attention, a lot of questions, and I thought this is the time to do something, so I wanted to choose something to do.
And so Lucas, a Brooklyn resident, approached Democratic Assemblywoman Amy Paulin of Scarsdale, telling her that a lot of child sex trafficking occurs in hotels, and legislation to educate hotel employees could make a difference. Here's Paulin.
I've introduced legislation that will require all hotels, motels, and other lodging facilities in New York to require all employees to take a human trafficking recognition training program, much like we've seen implemented here. Post in plain view and in conspicuous place in the lobby and in public restrooms a notice which will include the National Human Trafficking Hotline's telephone number.
Paulin modeled her bill after legislation in Connecticut, which passed a similar law in 2016.
Trafficking takes place in properties ranging from economy motels in the suburbs to luxury hotels in major cities. And, you know, you look around here and you would never suspect, but you don't know.
Paulin discussed her bill at the Ritz-Carlton in White Plains, which is owned by Marriott International. Tu Rincha is director of corporate social responsibility for Marriott. She says the company put in place a human trafficking training requirement in January.
Requiring human trafficking training of all our hotel associates in our 6,000 properties around the world so that they can better understand how to identify the many signs of human trafficking.
So far, 86% of Marriott's employees have undergone the 30-minute training. William Yar is general manager of the Ritz-Carlton in White Plains, where he says some 85% or 185 employees have received the training.
What this has done is it opened the eyes, especially to some of our heart of the house or back of the house ladies and gentlemen. When doing this training with our housekeeping team, the questions and the aha moments just to know what to look for.
He adds,
for other general managers or other people, hospitality professionals, you know, we think of training as just another way to take our ladies and gentlemen off the floor. I have to pay them for not working, etc. But what are we looking at, 30 minutes to save a life? I mean, it's truly meaningful and impactful training, and it's one that's, I can tell you, can make a difference.
But there is not the requirement, as outlined in Paulin's bill, to post a notice that would include a hotline number. Marriott co-developed the training with ECPAT USA, a Brooklyn-based group that seeks to end commercial sexual exploitation of children. Carol Smolensky is a founder and executive director of ECPAT USA.
Everyone needs this training. Every hotel worker needs it. And we're going to save a lot of kids.
Lucas says she may have sought help had someone reached out to her, or if there were someone to call.
Because I was always looking to get out somehow. If I had seen one sign somewhere that would have said that a child is not a prostitute, for me, that would have made me think a lot, because I thought I was a prostitute. And I was never told otherwise.
Pollen says she's in the education phase with her bill.
My hope is to move the bill. My hope is to move the bill.
The bill has several co- and multi-sponsors in the Assembly, and Pollen says there will be a sponsor in the Senate. We're going to hear more about Annika Lucas's story. In addition to advocating for human trafficking recognition training in hotels, she is the founder and executive director of Liberation Prison Yoga. She runs a program at Rikers Island Jail Complex in New York City with incarcerated survivors of sex trafficking. I sat down with her after the press conference announcing Assemblywoman Amy Pollen's bill at the Ritz-Carlton. The conversation is not graphic, but may be disturbing to a younger audience.
I was sold by my family in 1969 as a six-year-old child. And I was sold into a murderous network where I should say people of the highest echelons of society were part of and were friends, like an exclusive club, if you will, where the children were maybe the most valuable commodity and used in certain ways for the after party. But this went further. This went further. It was very dark.
You talked about if you saw a number, if someone said, call this for help or do this to get help, you would have gone down that path.
Yes, eventually I would have called, maybe not right away, but I always, the first time I was taken to an orgy, I was horribly humiliated. I actually stood up and spoke up because I thought I would die if I didn't stand up for myself. And then I was threatened very graphically with my life to stay quiet, to not say anything. So I learned. But at the same time, there was part of me that always knew that what was being done to me was wrong. And I should say that that doesn't mean that I didn't become extremely attached to certain of the perpetrators who gave me things that I'd never received before, the parental things that I didn't receive before, certain kind of love, recognition of certain aspects of myself that were being reflected that I hadn't had reflected before.
Well, certainly, you know, it's your formative years.
You're becoming
who you are going to be.
Absolutely.
And who you became, what prompted you to speak out in the first place?
Well, I was very privileged to be able to spend many, many years focused, really placing my life in the context of the healing, which was a commitment that I made. Because I couldn't stand that I wasn't myself. But I had a sense of who I am and that I wasn't there yet. So that, I'm very fortunate to have had that as well. But it did take 30 years of actively working to get better. Before I knew that my guilt complex had receded and that I had the beginning of self-esteem, that I got it back. That I get to be me now. And when I had that, it just so happened that I was then ready to speak, and it just so happened I was interviewed, and the questions just led to my sharing something of the past, which then became a public story.
And how many years ago was this?
That was in 2013.
How did you get out of the trafficking? How did that end?
Well, I was trafficked in this network until 74, and I was rescued by someone from the inside. One of my perpetrators made a deal to get me out.
What country were you in, or did you go to after that?
Well, I was in Belgium, and I was told to go back home for a few years. My family could then not traffic me anymore, not take me there anymore. And I was given very precise instructions how I should live and where I should go. And that's why I'm in New York. That's why I never entered prostitution afterwards. It's why I never took drugs. It's why I never became an alcoholic. I mean, it was all very carefully laid out in those instructions.
You went back to your family?
Yes, I did, until I was 15, then I ran away, and then I was trafficked again. I left. No one stopped me. But I was trafficked again for another year by an older man.
In Belgium.
And then at 17, I left. I just left that relationship. It was just considered a relationship by everyone. It wasn't considered trafficking.
Talk to me about the prison yoga, the liberation prison yoga. When did that start? What does it do? Where do you do it? I want to hear all about it.
Well, I never really wanted to become a yoga teacher, but yoga had become a very important modality for my healing, especially with the meditation. So the spiritual path of yoga as just taking a practice and being able to fit what happened to me in this context, in this spiritual context for my life, this life. And the yoga practice, the physical practice, was a great physical therapy, and the meditation and the philosophy really helped me to put things in perspective. And, of course, the meditation itself is extremely important to be able to get a little distance from my young, sick self and the thought processes of that young, sick self. So that has been everything. And I wanted to... I didn't seek this. I did go into the prisons. I was drawn to a photo I saw of a prisoner just with their hands in namaste. And I was very moved. And I thought, wow, that's... I started to just... But then things happened. I didn't look to go in, but that's what happened. I found out there's no one doing this in New York. I found out there was no organization in New York, so I thought there should be one. People bringing yoga into the jails and prisons. So I first thought organization, then I thought, well, I better go in myself. And then when I went in, I realized, oh, these are my people. That's who I need to be with and teach yoga in the way that I wish I would have had it.
So are you just in the New York City area? Will you go anywhere, or is it just...
Well, we are in the jails in New York City, in Rikers Island and other jails in the metropolitan area. And then we're in Bedford Hills, the prison in Westchester, and at Taconic across the street. And then we're in Wallkill. These are state prisons. And then we're also in Danbury, the federal prison in Connecticut.
Is it men and women?
Yes.
And what has been the response?
Well, we are very much loved because we bring in kindness. I mean, as I said, it's not just a yoga class. We connect with people first. Forget about the yoga. We come to connect with people first. We make this heart-to-heart connection. And once that is done, we can maybe we have guided meditation for sure, then see what people's physical needs are and level, and so maybe we can move. But we are very much loved because I make sure that all our teachers are able to come from the heart and to not put themselves above the students and not put themselves in a position of an authority figure and not be the expert, the teacher. So just coming in and being genuine and being truthful and plain, I should say, is very impactful.
I wanted to make a not-so-smooth transition back to the trafficking and the bill. And what do you think is the most important aspect? What do you think will really be accomplished through, let's say, Assemblywoman Paulin's bill passes, which is pretty similar to the one in Connecticut?
Yes.
How will that help? What do you think is really tremendous about it?
Well, first of all, I think awareness for all hotel staff is key, so that the training is followed and that people know and that they have a protocol. I think sometimes I've spoken to hotel employees who say they have seen horrible things but didn't know what to do. So to have a protocol and to be able to take action, I think, is very it's going to be very helpful. And the signage, I think, is very important, not only for the victims, but also for everyone, for awareness that this happens everywhere. It's not just, like they said, an overseas issue.
Is there anything you really want a message to get across, if there's one or two things you could say?
Yeah, I like to think big. And so what I experienced in this network as a child, I was really with the 1%, you should say. You could call it 1%. You could call the people who rule the world were there. And I saw the dark side of that, what happens on the top, at the top, which we supposedly all have to aspire to get to the top. That's who rules us. That's the example that we're all supposed to follow. And the dark side of that is darker than anyone can imagine. So this power structure doesn't work. This patriarchic power structure that goes top to bottom, that doesn't work. So anything that anybody can do to work on, well, I work very hard on self-acceptance, you know? So that's what I can share. And I speak that language constantly when I'm inside in jails, in the prison. I share the language of self-acceptance. I share it in our workshops. People come from all over to do our workshops with Liberation Prison Yoga. And it is an example in those moments of what life could be like if we're rather tribal and egalitarian, and where there's room for all feelings and people can be respected for who they are and accepted where they are at, and there is room for the pain as well as the joy. And in fact, once someone shares something that can be very painful, the joy is also greater, and it's also felt in the room. So it's very powerful stuff, but it's a better paradigm.
You've spent decades healing.
Yes.
And healing is lifelong, right?
Yes.
It's always a work in progress.
Yes, absolutely. We're all traumatized.
We're all traumatized in our own ways, absolutely. In your healing, though, is there room for blame?
No. I always felt that intuitively that forgiveness is really important for me. And it's also an ongoing process, I can tell you that.
When you were saying before about being with the 1%, you know, you were in that club, which is a strange word to use in this.
Felt like a club.
I can't even imagine. You're talking about world leaders were part of this.
Yes.
Back in the early 70s, late yes. 60s, early 70s.
Yes. I recognized everyone later on. I had no idea they were world leaders because I saw their vulnerability, which they exposed to me so that I could come in as a mother figure to accept and hold it. So I saw their vulnerability and had no idea that they were world leaders. But later on, what I would do is just, well, this was before the internet. So if I'm sure that had anyone known about the internet, I would not have been alive today. But I would just type in the country, politician, and the year. And pretty much right away I would find that person, find my perpetrator that way.
I don't know what you can and cannot say. Anyone from the U.S.?
Yes.
Leaders?
In a way.
Not presidents?
Not presidents that I never saw an American president, no.
But certainly an up there figure.
Absolutely.
And across the world.
And across the world. It was a world network. It was not just Belgium.
Right, no, I got that impression. Are you physically okay?
Thank you. I was harmed physically, but I'm strong. And the yoga practice certainly helped a lot with that.
Do you have a family?
I have a daughter.
How old is she?
She's 16. So my daughter is the reason that I went as deep as I did in my healing process.
That was Annika Lucas, child sex trafficking survivor and founder of Liberation Prison Yoga.
Fly, fly, for angels to fly, to fly, to fly, angels to die.
When service members return from the battlefield with lifetime disabilities, their spouses often become full-time caregivers. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have drafted more than 1 million family members into that role, and their needs are overwhelming a government program designed to help them. Bobby O'Brien reports from Tampa, Florida.
Inside the home of Ken and Patty Cattart, northeast of Sarasota, a bouquet of bright red roses sits on the kitchen pass-through. Patty bought them for herself.
Ken, he's not very mushy anymore.
And I do get you flowers.
For my birthday.
They laugh now, but it's been 10 long years of learning to live with Ken's loss of memory and cognitive impairment, as his caregiver Patty now knows to buy her own flowers.
Ken's not, he doesn't emotionally attach anymore. And I've learned that I know he loves me. I have no doubt about that. But I also learned to love myself better.
In May 2007, Ken's truck was hit by 2 roadside bombs during his 15-month deployment in Iraq. Only upon his return did Ken learn that he had suffered a traumatic brain injury, a blown disc in his neck, a back injury, hearing loss. The list goes on. From complex symptoms, such as seizures, to simple things, like he can no longer remember how to write his name in cursive.
Things have really slowed down for me. You know, I cannot lift a whole lot of weight. There's a bunch of things that I can't physically do.
His invisible head injury left him with balance problems and other medical issues that prevent him from holding a job or doing even small household tasks. But Ken counts himself lucky. He has all his limbs and can walk. Patty manages his medical appointments, medications, and rehabilitation while raising their 3 children and handling the household. It overwhelmed her a few years ago.
I wasn't suicidal, but I was in a dark place. Not only was I dealing with being a caregiver, but I had a mom who had cancer and my dad was unhealthy.
She learned to care for herself and found a job working from home, helping other military families. Patty also is a fellow with the Elizabeth Dole Foundation that advocates for military and veteran caregivers. Executive Director Stephen Schwab says the post-9/11 caregivers are typically thrown into their roles without time to prepare.
So many of these young spouses in their 20s and 30s suddenly realizing that they're going to be caregivers for probably the next 50 years, if not their entire life, and no one was handing them a manual.
The Dole Foundation surveyed caregivers to find out what they needed most. Respite care topped their list.
These caregivers, especially the post-9/11 caregivers, are struggling from high rates of depression and anxiety. They're incredibly isolated. And when I say isolated, I mean they feel alone, and in most cases are alone without a support system.
The VA has a special program for caregivers of severely injured veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. It provides financial help and other services. Cynthia Fletcher is a caregiver support coordinator at Tampa's James A. Haley VA.
The majority of our veterans in this program do have post-traumatic stress, mood disorders, and TBI. So the caregivers are struggling with those behavioral disturbances, those mood disturbances, which can be very challenging.
The VA secretary asked Congress in March to expand the post-9/11 caregivers program. Of particular concern to caregivers like Patty Catter is what happens 20 or 30 years out if Ken's memory problems worsen and she is unable to cope.
Or what if something happens to me? Who's going to take care of him? Our kids have been very resilient. They love their father, but I don't want that to fall on their plate.
The VA estimated 4,000 caregivers would qualify for its post-9/11 program, but within 4 years, almost 25,000 were enrolled. So the VA has been scrambling to fill the immediate demand, leaving little time to think about the caregivers' long-term needs. I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1451.